When the Vietnam War ended, there was still more than 2,500 men who had served there, fought in the war, that were missing in action. They were unaccounted for. Now, it's certainly the case that in all wars, men have always gone missing. And in the past, the United States has made an effort to recover the remains of some of the soldiers that have fallen in combat. But never before, not in previous conflicts, has the government ever made the kind of commitment that it made to the families of people who fought in Vietnam, that the attempt would be made to recover remains from everyone. Where it is possible to recover them, for everyone where it's possible. And this work has fallen to a unit of the government that we'll be talking about in this part of Focus 580 that is, in fact, the biggest forensic lab in the world. It's the Central Identification Laboratory, and it's based in Hawaii. This morning, we'll be talking with a journalist who, as far as anybody knows, is the first journalist who has ever gone along and followed this effort through one of these efforts to locate and recover remains from start to finish. His name is Earl Swift. He's a staff writer for the Virginian Pilot newspaper of Norfolk, Virginia, where he has his home. And he's authored a book on that, which has just come out recently. It's titled Where They Lay, Searching for America's Lost Soldiers, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. It's out there in bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. Questions, comments certainly are welcome if you'd like to call in. Talk with our guests. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that people try to be brief in their comments and questions so that we can keep the program moving along and get as many callers as are interested. But anyone's welcome to join the conversation. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good. And that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL and toll free 800-222-WILL if you're interested in being a part of the show. Mr. Swift, hello.
David, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks for talking with us.
I'm very happy to do that.
I appreciate it. There, as I said, obviously in war, people go missing, and that's happened probably as long as there's been war. And in fact, one of the figures that you give in the book is that there are 78,000 men, presumably mostly men, service people, who have never been recovered from World War II. So obviously that's a fact of life in combat. But here it is the case that as far as the missing from Vietnam are concerned, is the government made this commitment that it hadn't done in the past. And one of the questions you deal with is why is that? Why do you think in this particular case the government said, we're going to do everything possible where we think it's possible to find remains of these people and bring them back to their families?
That's true. And the 78,000 figure strikes comes as a great surprise to people, I think. Vietnam, those who went unaccounted for received a lot of attention at the time, probably much more so than in any previous war, mostly because of the nature of the way the war ended, with our not controlling the battlefield, with our not having access to the places that those men disappeared. And it's the 2,583 men who were unaccounted for at war's end was a remarkably small number as wars go. If you take a tour of, say, Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond, Virginia, you will see acres of graves on which there are no names. They just say, you know, the unidentified dead from, and then they'll list the battle, you know, Malvern Hill or whatever. The numbers are small with Vietnam, and the commitment is perhaps a little more realistic, consequently.
Well, and I suppose that it is aided in part by, and I suppose this is relatively recent, but our ability to identify remains, to use DNA testing, and to actually, if we have some remains, to say with some fair level of confidence that this You know, if it's a place where we know one person or a couple of people were lost, it's not an, we're not talking about a bunch of people. We're talking about maybe one or two people. We have a pretty good idea who they were. And though this way we can say for certain that whatever remains are located, that they are in fact the remains of a particular person. And in the past, that's not something that we really could do.
That's true. The DNA is tricky. Actually, technology has kind of worked both ways. It certainly elevated the expectation of folks back home that anyone killed in Vietnam would be brought home. And that was something that wasn't necessarily an expectation in the past. Refrigeration, chemical preservation, led to a widespread expectation that that American soldiers would not be buried on foreign battlefields, as had occurred in World War II and World War I, etc. The DNA, on the other hand, has made it a lot easier to, DNA analysis has made it much more easy to, as you say, distinguish one soldier from the next once bones are recovered. It's a tricky technology in that it is not the DNA analysis with which most Americans are familiar. This is not the same DNA analysis that is used, for instance, to liberate a wrongly accused prisoner from a penitentiary, or to establish the guilt of a rape suspect. This is a that kind of DNA analysis uses the DNA contained in the nuclei of the body's cells, and we get that DNA from both of our parents. The DNA that is used in this analysis is mitochondrial DNA. It's contained in the mitochondria, the tiny power plants of our cells, and through a quirk of nature, we inherit only our mother's mitochondrial DNA. It comes down our maternal lines. And barring mutation, we have an exact duplicate of our mother's DNA, mitochondrial DNA, and she has an exact duplicate of her mother's, and so on through generations, which makes it tricky because you can have cousins that you're not aware that you have who have exactly the same mitochondrial DNA that you have. They can be, cousins 50 steps removed, and you can share that mitochondrial DNA. So you can't actually identify someone with certainty using mitochondrial DNA analysis. But what you can do is trace the maternal lines. Say you have two guys who are recovered from the field. You can do DNA tracings on both of their families and at least eliminate, you can establish that bone A is more likely to belong to soldier A because it does match his mitochondrial DNA, whereas it does not match the DNA of soldier B.
As you mentioned, the official number is of missing 2,583.
At war's end, not anymore.
At war's at war's end. Well, here I guess the question I'm going for is that when you talk about how the remains of how many individuals might be recoverable, the fact is that some of these people, knowing the circumstances, how it is that they were killed, you would have to say there is just no possibility of recovering those. So when you eliminate all of those that have been recovered, and if you then take off those people who would say, because of the circumstances, we just say it's just not possible. So then how many people are you left with?
Well, there are not only 600 or 700 folks who have been identified at this point. It's close to 700. But there are also a number of recoveries that have taken place. They took place before mitochondrial DNA presented itself as a potential identification solution, and they are thus in the pipeline. The United States possesses the remains. They have not been definitively linked to an unaccounted for soldier yet. So several hundred cases constitute, are included in that pool as well. When you add that to the number of folks who are simply unrecoverable, you're left with about the same number that have already been recovered, 600 or 700, about a quarter of the total. Hmm. And those are the active candidates for recovery at this point.
Let me introduce again our guest, Earl Swift. He's a staff writer for the Virginian Pilot newspaper of Norfolk, Virginia, and he is the author of the book Where They Lay, Searching for America's Lost Soldiers. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and it tells the story of the Central Identification Laboratory and the people who work for that lab. It's based in Hawaii. It's the largest forensic lab in the world, and these are the people that go looking for remains, bring them back to the laboratory, do analysis to try to see if they can identify them. And once that happens, then those remains are then given back to the families. And if you're interested in reading the story, it's quite interesting, and it's out now in the bookstores. And, of course, questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455. So how is it that you got interested in this story and decided that you wanted to tell it?
Well, I was the military editor of the Virginian Pilot a few years ago, and among my duties was to visit the Armed Forces Staff College. It's now called the Joint Forces Staff College, which is in Norfolk. And it's a postgraduate school for mid-level military career officers. So you see Army Lieutenant Colonels, you see Navy Commanders, folks at that level. And one of the things they do is learn how to deal with the media. And they had asked me to come out occasionally to give classes, and I was giving a class on how to deal with people like me, which was a pretty self-serving exercise, I have to be honest. Afterwards, a tall, bald Army Lieutenant Colonel approached me and said that he liked what I had to say, and I followed that with, "Have I got a story for you?" And it turned out that his name was Franklin Childress, who was the public affairs officer for the Joint Task Force in Hawaii that managed the lab's affairs on these missions to Southeast Asia. And the more he talked, the more amazed I was. I had no idea that the U.S. Spent $100 million a year and devoted such huge human resources to this continuing, last mission of the Vietnam War. Had no idea that the lab also flew into Papua New Guinea several times a year to look for World War II air crews that continued to be unaccounted for. Just had heard none of that. Mm-hmm. And so the following summer, I arranged with a photographer at the paper accompanying me to go over to Vietnam with Lieutenant Colonel Childress and to visit several of the digs that were underway at that time, most of them up around the former DMZ in the country's middle, slender waste. After that, I went back to Laos the following March to a mountaintop crash site where a Navy patrol plane had smacked into a cliff and killed all 9 men aboard, and was there observing as those 9 men were recovered, along with their dog mascot. And then realized that I was writing the second story for a magazine and realized that both trips were just too big to really shoehorn into a newspaper or magazine. This is a much bigger story, and it seemed a good book, so I arranged to go back a third time, this time to spend the entire duration of a dig with the team to go over with it, to actually dig myself, become a member of the team, and then to fly home with them. Was very fortunate that the lab agreed to that, and I got to join an excavation for a 4-man crew of a UH-1 Huey helicopter that was shot down in March of 1971 during a mostly forgotten but pivotal battle in Laos called Lam Son 719, which is largely widely regarded as both the Army's probably proudest day in aviation and also its darkest. It was an attempted invasion of Laos using South Vietnamese troops, We didn't have any troops on the ground, but we did ferry all the South Vietnamese troops in American helicopters over the border, and they met an incredibly intense North Vietnamese artillery and ground fire reception that claimed an awful lot of helicopters, and this one was one of them.
Perhaps you could talk some more at this point about the Central Identification Laboratory and about the people that work there, and because some of them are military people, some of them are civilians. What sort of technical expertise or background training do these people come to this work with?
Well, there are 30 civilian anthropologists attached to the lab, and I don't know the exact breakdown, but a significant number hold doctorates in physical anthropology, and those who don't are candidates. And so you've got a mix of folks with masters and doctorates in that discipline. It's physical anthropology as practiced by the lab is very similar to a crime scene investigation sort of approach to the science. They treat a site at which a soldier has gone missing as a crime scene with the rules of evidence that you would see in a big city detective bureau, and they usually arrive at a site after a great deal of detective work has been performed just to pinpoint the location at which it's, you know, they should dig with the greatest odds of success, and they are remarkably young people for the most part. There are a couple of old timers who have been who are old enough to have served in Vietnam, but just a couple. Most of the anthropologists are in their 20s and 30s. The military side of the operation, there are, like I said, 30 anthropologists, 100 and 100 plus military folks who constitute the biggest part of the team. Each recovery team usually has 13 people in it, so you have 12 military led by a junior officer, a captain, usually Army captain or Marine captain, and assisted by a number of sergeants. The military folks tend to be almost as young as the anthropologists in the main. Some of the senior sergeants can climb into their 40s, but generally they're in their 30s tops as well. So you've got a very young, very dedicated, very disciplined workforce, really. And at home, it's spending a month at a time in very uncomfortable circumstances. You know, as far from air conditioning and American popular culture as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it from your account, obviously, it goes far beyond simply being uncomfortable. It's also not only is it just uncomfortable, but it's also extremely dangerous.
It is.
In this particular case, there were poisonous snakes, and there was I guess in any time you investigate a site like this, there's always the possibility of unexploded ordnance, bombs and things that might still be sitting there or might be buried. And so in addition to the fact that conditions are very, would just be tough and unpleasant, there are real dangers there that people have to be conscious of as they go about doing their work.
There are. And in Laos, especially, the unexploded ordnance problem is a real one. Millions of unexploded bombs, mines, and such, you know, shells are still unfound in the landscape, and it's a real worry when you're digging, and you're pushing that shovel blade, you know, a foot underground, that you're going to have a metal on metal contact. That's not something you want to happen. There are posters, public service posters, in pretty much every Lao village that I visited that publicize the dangers of UXO and illustrate pretty graphically, you know, what can happen if you pick up an anti-personnel bomb. Let's say they do not hedge in their depictions. bomblets look like toys. They look like little, you know, little. They're baseball sized. They're round. They look like a ball. And so a lot of the victims of UXO are kids who unknowingly just pick it up. And 30 years after it was dropped and proved it dead, you know, it's been baking in the equatorial heat all this time, getting touchier by the day, and it doesn't take much for it to go off.
Yeah, that's sad, but that's I think that's the story the world over with these things. Battlefields everywhere, that's
sure.
That's a fact.
Yeah, the Mennonite Church has taken a real lead in the Lao problem, and now there's a multinational effort designed to sweep the countryside and gradually rid Laos of some of these dangers. It's slow going.
I'm sure that when people, when the teams go on these efforts, they do they have some idea, and they've got to have some idea of where to look. But given that, once they get to a particular place, then though how much area do they carve out and say, well, we think somewhere around here is the place to look, but obviously it may be a pretty big area. How much territory do they have to try to cover? To get exactly what they're looking for.
It varies by the sort of incident that led to the soldier being lost. In an air crash, you usually have some sort of impact crater, or you have a center point from which you can spread the dig. You know, you have with a jet, the crater is going to be readily discernible usually, even after 30 years. A helicopter less so. You get as much information as you can get about the speed that the aircraft was traveling, the angle of attack on which it came in and hit the ground. All of these things will speak to the debris field, its shape, its size, and how far from that initial point of impact you'll need to dig to collect all the evidence that the site has to offer. What's much tougher are the isolated burials of soldiers who were not killed in air crashes, who were just killed in a firefight and buried by the Vietnamese, whether it be by villagers or by a North Vietnamese Army unit. The isolated burials, finding them depends on the memories of the folks who were there when they were buried, and those memories are often tied to physical landmarks, the presence of a tree or of a gully, which may, with all the monsoon rains and the resulting mudslides, with all the slash and burn agricultural work that may have occurred in the intervening years, you know, those landmarks may not exist anymore. And without those landmarks, the locals are as clueless as to where to look as we would be. So there's a wide range of probability attached to these things. Some of them you can go in with a very high expectation that you're going to have success, and know that you can do it with a pretty small grid. And some it's pretty much it's guesstimating.
The information that's provided by the people who live around this place turns out to be very important. Obviously, you're asking, you go there and you ask them, did you see this happen? Were you around? Have you been to this place? Can you show us anything? And obviously, also those people have, anything that's left that they can use, they're going to do that. So that's part of the problem too, is that a lot of material evidence, thing that could be useful, likely have been carried off, and probably a long time ago, by people who lived around there. Because anything that I'm sure anything that would be salvageable, they thought they could use, they would do that.
That's true, and in Laos especially, there's a salvaging culture to both Vietnam and Laos. I think rural people are used to building their homes and solving engineering problems with whatever they have at hand. And if there's a big pile of aircraft aluminum lying around, they're going to use it. I mean, it only makes sense that they would. In Laos, it's the quality of eyewitness reports that you get is particularly bad, because most of the villagers around the Ho Chi Minh Trail, say, during Lam San 719 and the other particularly hot periods of bombing, fled the scene. They got out of there. They either holed up in caves or they moved westward and just vacated whole part of the country. And then they came back in weeks, months after the fighting, found all this wreckage, and really could tell Americans decades later very little as to what happened to the bodies. They weren't there either. And then, as you say, they began picking apart the wreck sites. And it's not unusual to arrive at the location of a crash, sometimes a very large airplane, and to be able to see nothing at first glance to indicate that it's anything but an empty rice paddy or a mountainside. Some of the scavenging is extremely efficient. The site that we dug for these four gentlemen on the helicopter the site was picked clean. I would never have guessed that a helicopter was there. There's nothing to indicate it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Earl Swift. He is a staff writer for the Virginian Pilot newspaper, Norfolk, Virginia, where he makes his home. And he's the author of the book Where They Lay, Searching for America's Lost Soldiers. And it tells the story of the effort to locate and recover remains of soldiers killed in Vietnam, actually not just in Vietnam, but also in other wars where Americans have fought. This work is being done by folks who work for the Central Identification Laboratory. It is the world's largest forensic lab. It's based in Hawaii, and he had the opportunity to go along with a team from the lab as they made this attempt to went into Laos to see if they could recover the remains of these soldiers that were killed in the helicopter crash during the Vietnam War. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
If I could just tell a story that illustrates just how different scavenging can be in different parts of the world.
Sure.
In October of 2000, there was a plane crash, a Lao Aviation flight. It was a Chinese-built Yak-12, which is kind of like our Dash 8, a little commuter airliner, with 15 people aboard, smacked into a mountaintop in eastern Laos. And the Lao government had no way to reach the site. It was way up, and the weather was bad. And so they turned to an American team that was digging for Vietnam-era remains and asked if they could put our people, our anthropologist and his team, to work helping the injured, reaching the injured, and maybe saving some lives in this accident. And so I spoke to the anthropologist who got up there. He got up there it was a day after the crash. And by the time he reached it, there were several survivors still. They had broken bones. They were in bad shape, but they were savable. And, of course, there were many fatalities as well. But what struck him was that there were also 100 villagers at the site who had climbed this mountain from the villages at the mountain's foot. And they were all holding pieces of airplane. And it became clear that in their haste to dismantle the aircraft and salvage the metal from it, they had stepped over the injured who were pain-racked and moaning in the wreckage to unbolt panels from the plane and carry it off. Then you go to Papua New Guinea, where an awful lot of American bombers and fighter planes are still hidden in the jungle of the Owen Stanley Range on the main island and in the jungles of New Britain, one island to the north. And it's almost as if they've been maintained as shrines. They're completely untouched. They have not been salvaged at all, because the prevailing view there is that they're tombs, they're graves, and it's bad juju to disturb them. And so you'll sometimes come upon wreck sites in Papua New Guinea that personal effects are still scattered about the smashed cockpits of these planes. You'll see sidearms that have just been left on the ground. No one's touched them. Hmm. When I was there in the summer of 2001, I visited a B-17 site in New Britain, and the plane was essentially intact. We climbed up this trail and came around a corner. corner through the jungle, and there was a clearing ahead in the banana trees, and a shaft of sunlight coming down through this clearing illuminated a B-17 tail that was sitting upright. You could still read the yellow numbers painted on its tail. It was like something out of Indiana Jones. Hmm.
For those places where the wreckage is not intact like that, I'm thinking that probably, you know, anybody who's taken an introductory course in anthropology or maybe seen some documentaries on what anthropologists do have this sense of how a dig goes. The idea that you mark off a space, and what you do is in a very gentle and deliberate and slow way, you very slowly strip off layers of the soil, going through that sometimes with sieves and straining it out and looking for just really small pieces of things. And maybe you're looking for pot shards or you know, whatever. And in this particular case, I'm sure that people are looking for anything they can find, including human remains. Is that the way that this is done, like we've seen it done in documentaries and
well, so it is it bears a pretty strong resemblance to classic archaeology, you know, in the field. With the exception that the gentleness to which you referred probably isn't as faithfully adhered to as you might see at a Mesoamerican site or something. It's battlefield anthropology and in every sense of the word. You only have a month to get as much done as possible, and you're facing bad weather an awful lot of the time, and some real physical dangers, not only from the terrain and the nature of the site itself, but also, you know, the animal life that you share it with, and there's just not a lot of time, so you don't see people pulling out the whisk brooms. And very carefully shaving, you know, a millimeter of earth away at a time. You see guys getting out shovels and going down a foot at a time. And when it's all over, it certainly looks like a university archaeological project. It's got a flat floor, nice squared sides to the excavation. It's very pretty, and it's very carefully gridded. That part is all. It has that in common with the kind of classic scenario, but the speed at which the work is done is pretty extreme, and it is thorough. I do want to emphasize that the sieve part of it, the sifting of the earth, is step two. Everything is sifted. Everything goes through a quarter inch screen, and so anything of a quarter inch in size or bigger is going to be found and is retained and analyzed. And there's an analysis in the field, and then the promising stuff is taken back to the lab and analyzed again. Mm-hmm.
You say that when a team goes out to do this, they have a month. They know that they have that much. How do they know when they're done? How do you say, do you come to a point where you say, we have recovered enough material, and then we'd say, even if we could go on, we would say, no, that's it, we're done, and we'll take what we've got, and that's that? And
generally, they don't do that. What they'll do is they'll dig until the site can offer no more evidence. So they'll reach a point where they judge, okay, we're not going to get anything more out of this site. We've exhausted it. But you won't see them walk away from a site because they have enough to make the ID. Generally, they're going to recover as much of the unaccounted for soldier as they can. And so the prevailing approach is to keep digging until there's no digging left to do. There was the second dig that I went on, the mountaintop plane crash, required two full excavations, and one of them had to be extended, and the other had to have a second team brought in to bolster the first team, just so that they could get it done in 2 years. But in that case, you had weather that really restricted when teams could work, and it had to be during the dry season in March. And so once that first dig was completed, and or the first dig came to an end, you know, that month ended, and the Laotian government was ready to kick the teams out. And it was clear that there was a lot more digging left to do. The lab just said, okay, well, you know, we'll suspend everything. We'll be back in a year. We'll try to bang it out then.
Just how cooperative or uncooperative have the governments in the region been in this effort?
Well, I think the cooperation has increased steadily over the years. In fact, just recently, just in the last 2 weeks, the Vietnamese have entered into a military-to-military agreement with the United States, which will actually allow our naval ships to call on ports there for the first time since 1975. So that's that would have been unheard of just a few years ago. I mean, unimaginable. Clearly, the big driver for the countries of Southeast Asia is economic. They can't afford to maintain the distance that they have in the past, and this has been this issue, the MIA recovery issue, so-called MIA recovery issue, has been the readiest means of getting the two governments together. Since 1985, we've been sending people into Laos in search of remains, and since the early 90s to Vietnam. This is right now. There are 145 Americans over there on digs, and there are 50 in Laos, and there are 95 in Vietnam. And it is the, let me see if I can remember this. I believe it's the 81st mission, 81st time that we've sent teams to Laos, and it marks the 75th time that we've sent teams to Vietnam.
Some of these people, as you say, they have been trained in physical anthropology, and you could imagine they could be doing a similar kind of work. I suppose they could be working in law enforcement. You know, they could do forensics that way. They could be archaeologists, and they could be investigating the remains and the leavings of people who were long, long, long gone. Do they have a sense that what they are doing, however, in this particular work is somehow special, and what does it to them? What does it mean?
Well, I think, with a few exceptions, the veterans among the anthropologists at the lab have worked for universities, you know, in South America, South American digs. They have worked for law enforcement. They've worked for medical examiners' offices in the United States. So they have a pretty good perspective on how their job is completely unique. It's I think most of them find it enormously exciting, and for good reason. It is. It's such a great blend of serious science and over the top adventure. I'd be hard pressed to come up with another blend that does both so well, really. And I think they, after a while, come to... At first, I think the adventure is what draws them to the job. But I've spoken to an awful lot of anthropologists with the lab who come to see the work as almost sacred over time. They, they go to a memorial service for a soldier they've recovered, and they walk away different people from things like that. They come to see that what they're doing has a it not only answers academic or intellectual questions the way other branches of anthropology might, but it really makes a difference to people here and now. It affects lives and families.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I just want to introduce one more time our guest, Earl Swift. He's a journalist. He's a staff writer for the Virginian Pilot newspaper in Norfolk, Virginia. He's the author of the book Where They Lay, Searching for America's Lost Soldiers. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and it's about his experiences going along with a team that worked for the Central Identification Laboratory based in Hawaii. It's the largest forensic lab in the world, and over a period of years now, they have been involved in trying to locate and recover remains of soldiers, American soldiers, killed in wars, including Vietnam, but also the World War II. And actually, I think that some of these people even were involved in dealing with some remains found in the wreck of the Monitor.
You're so right.
From the Civil War. So obviously we're not just talking about Vietnam here. We're talking about some other American wars as well. The recovery effort costs $100 million a year. And I suppose some people would ask the following question and raise the question about whether that's worth spending that money. And I suppose if there's somebody listening who has lost a family member in war, I hope they would forgive me raising the question. They probably would say, well, that's only the kind of question that someone who has never lost a loved one in a war would even think about asking. But I'm sure that some people would say, you know, if somebody is missing in action and it's been that long, you would have to assume that person was dead and would ask, you know, does it really matter to have some bone fragments back? If it's been that long, you know the person is dead. What is the point of taking all of this trouble to try to locate what you can locate?
Right. Well, there are a couple of kind of blasphemous questions I guess you can ask about this, and surprisingly, I don't think it's true that the only people asking the question you just asked are folks who have never lost a loved one in a war, because I encounter that question time and again when I return from Laos and told people what I had been doing. And I got it most often from veterans. That's the thing that really surprised me. Now, not Vietnam veterans. Uniformly, Vietnam veterans responded with great interest and a great deal of admiration for what the lab was doing. But I heard it a lot from older veterans, and I think it's almost the opposite of what you suggested. We had 78,000 soldiers who died and never came back from World War II, and they included Marines who went ashore at Tinian and were shot in the surf and went out on the next tide. And there was never an expectation that we would try to get their bodies. Their families got a black bordered telegram, and that was that. And you dealt with it. And I think that there are folks of that generation who see this as an enormous waste of money, and that spending $100 million is not going to bring them back. So why are we doing it? You know, they're buried now. Leave them where they lay. And that's one point of view. I think that if you were to talk to any of the families of the folks who are unaccounted for, you would get a completely different reaction. Needless to say.
Well, and you did have that opportunity. This helps us finally have some closure?
You know, I'm not even sure that the actual recovery means as much as the government's endeavor to do it. It's almost it's the looking more than the finding, almost, that counts for something, I think. Because there are those hundreds who will never be recovered, who were in planes that went down in deep water, whose grave sites have been washed away over the years and will never be found. And the families of those folks are filled, those I've spoken with have been very grateful for this continuing effort. I guess one of the big shocks that does occasionally happen is that, when you hear that a recovery operation's underway, and you're the parent, the brother, the son, or whatever of an unaccounted for soldier, I think sometimes you get the mistaken impression that you're going to get what we normally think of as remains back. And some of these remains are very meager. They can be as little as one tooth. There's not much left.
Is it now the intention of the government to continue this effort and to keep going until they have made an attempt now to recover remains from all of the people that they think that they have even a reasonable chance of recovering?
Well, the That's the $64 question. The when and how do you decide that you've given it your best shot? And I don't know the answer to that. I know John McCain has suggested that there will come a time, and it's not far off, when we will reach that point of diminishing returns and increasing dangers to our present-day soldiers and scientists, where we just have to back off and say, okay, we just can't do this anymore. I don't know whether we'll know it when we get to that point. It's not going to be a happy occasion when it happens, I suspect. But that is that's an issue that is yet to play out.
Well, how do you think that some of the people you came to know who do this work would react if one day the government said, well, okay, we're done?
Well, I don't think they'll say we're done completely. There are the folks who staff these teams are mortuary affairs specialists, most of them, and the Army has just one active duty company of mortuary affairs specialists at Fort Lee, Virginia. This is field training for them. So I think there's a practical side to all of this in the Army's present day needs, and that is to keep its people sharp in how you handle battlefield casualties. So I don't think they'll abandon it completely. They may, however, reach the conclusion that in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, there's just not much left to be got.
Well, there we will have to leave the conversation. I want to make sure again for people who are listening, if you're interested in reading about this effort that we've been discussing, the book that we've talked about is titled Where They Lay. The subtitle is Searching for America's Lost Soldiers. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, by our guest Earl Swift. He's a staff writer for the Virginian Pilot of Norfolk, Virginia, where he makes his home. Mr. Swift, I want to say to you thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
David, thanks so much.